Boy, it's come up that some of the terminology I use is not readily understandable. A gun team is two weapon ships. A scout team, two of the scout ships. A team is two. Now, the reason why you see this lonesome out here, there's a different organization within the aircraft troop of the aircraft squadron than what exists in the armored cavalry squadron aircraft troop. This is the aircraft troop of the aircraft squadron. It has an additional scout ship. 9 and 1 is 10. Your rifle platoon, 5 ships. Your weapons, as you can see here, you got 10 of them. Now the reason why I started out with this point is that if you're a brigade commander and you've got a troop that's supporting you or attached to you, it's good that you know what you can get out of this troop. Well, to begin with, over the long period that I was over there and I looked at some statistics yesterday, you'll be lucky in your weapon ships of a cav troop to maintain 65 or 70% if that troop's doing its job. Why? Combat damage. Now they'll have accidents too, but combat damage is the deciding factor on this availability. We don't have enough sheet metal repair in Army aviation today in Vietnam unless they've increased it tremendously recently. And with these ships taking the beating that they do, you need a lot of sheet metal repair. So you figure it out. You've either got 6 or 7 of these gunships a day. You fight to keep 4 of the 5 lift ships going. At least in this squadron, the full squad was moved in the ship. And that usually was 7 or 8 men, depending on whether they'd been in a fight the day before. Now this isn't true in all units. They don't always carry a full squad. That's why I made that statement. And you have to recognize that varying conditions all over the zone, all over Vietnam, do result in differences in lift capability. I maximize the use of these lift ships to support the rifle squad, and I don't like splitting a rifle squad in 2 lifts, which is what happens if you don't move them like we did. So you have 4 squads, and if you have less than 4 ships, you're going to have difficulty putting 1 platoon in and 1 lift. And a lot of times you're putting this platoon in some rather risky situations, and you don't want to make 2 lifts with 1 little rifle. But you can expect that they'll fight to keep 4 of them flying. This one ship is that one spare that they have. They'll always be working on 1 morning, noon, and night to make sure they got 4 the next day. Because one of these things comes down for maintenance about every day. The scout ships, now I don't know what the rate of availability is on this new ship, OH-6, but in the H-13s, we were again lucky to keep 6 or 7 flying every day because of combat damage. And you remember that these ships are flying from before dawn. You'll have a first light flight with scouts. If we put 2 scout teams up at first light, there'll be 1 gun team up in general support. So that if the scout team gets in trouble, you got 1 gun team up. And you'll have 1 or more of these teams up all day long, depending on the kind of mission that they have in aerial surveillance in your sector.
Jim?
Yes.
Don't ever take those scout guys up on riding with them on one of those morning flights. Make you sicker than a dog. They will put that H-13 in the most ungodly place you ever saw. Stand on the end and go round and round a circle.
Yes, it's not good for you to have had a bad night if you've never flown like this, because like I say, it's more like a hummingbird than anything. And if you're watching the ground and all at once you're doing this like they'll do with pedal turns at low speed, you can get sick.
It ain't like riding on an H-13. That's just a hint to the wise. I found out the hard way.
Now I want to go right from that. You think I covered that?
Yeah, Jim, I think so. One thing about this, that I point out, Jim, that in the, notice the organization up there, you got 3 separate organizations. 1 scout, 1 platoon, and 1 for fire support that can also scout for you.
Now, these ships, obviously, they're looking for the enemy. Everybody's intelligence-oriented over there, as I pointed out in my previous Vietnam presentation. Your infantry is searching for the enemy 90% of the time. They're recon forces. It's not just this outfit that's looking for the enemy, but it's this unit that has the integral organization that gives it the reaction. It's the only one that has it integrated at the lowest level. Each brigade, in the standard division, you've got six H-13s or H-23s or OH-6s in your brigade aviation platoon. Now, when I left Vietnam, I visited one day with each of the divisions. And except for occasions when the infantry battalion commanders in these other divisions got in an H-23 or H-13, those ships were never used as scouts. Now, in the 1st Cavalry Division, in the aviation platoon, we have 5 command and control ships, Hueys, and 8 H-13s. And depending upon the personality of the brigade commander, those H-13s are used as scouts. And of course, in my case, when I moved over to the brigade, I emphasize this because we never had enough scouts for the reasons I've given you here in this troop. So I had a scout, a very experienced scout pilot transferred from the squadron, from my supporting troop, which was A troop, over to this platoon. I swapped a pilot with him, in other words, and I had him train all my H-13 pilots as scout pilots. And in about 2 months, as I harassed the cavalry squadron commander, my brigade scout pilots, I thought, were better than his. Now, I maximized their employment down in the infantry battalions. I wouldn't let these things be used, except by personal approval, mine, as an administrative vehicle. And I was always happy when I saw either an infantry battalion commander, although he had his command and control ship, he didn't need it, but a company commander in the air reconnoitering his area. I put priority on this because, as I mentioned back there a while ago, you get on the ground, even in the rice paddy country, and your visibility is that first hedgerow. And if you've got 3 rifle platoons searching, and you as a company commander are with 1 platoon, presumably the center one, your visibility is that first hedgerow. And you can have a platoon sliced off and in a real stiff fight, and you won't have any control over it, especially if the radio operator is the first man to get hit in that platoon. So I emphasize the use of scouts down at the company level, because that company commander with his radio is talking to his people, and he can see every platoon. Of course, if they get in a fight, he gets on the ground. But at least he knows then exactly where they're in a fight and what has to be done. I just hope that all of you either go to the 1st Cavalry Division or wind up with a recommendation approved that we made, and that is that every brigade aviation brigade platoon should have these command and control ships. A battalion commander with his liaison officer, artillery liaison officer, and if he's got a FAC, with his FAC, and either with his sergeant major or one of his staff officers, you can run your battalion from that command and control ship, and you can see everything. You know exactly what's going on. And that's the way the battalion commanders operated most of the time in the 1st Cav. Now, in the other divisions, you don't have those 5 ships in that brigade aviation platoon, so you're dependent on the divisional battalion to provide you with something. Well, they have so few command and control ships that by the time you get down to battalion level, they're out. They just don't have enough, in other words. I wrote an essay here recommending that these ships be provided and pointing out that, in my opinion, the effectiveness of the battalions very well might depend greatly on this. And you can talk to Ken Mertel or Bob Lytle and get their opinions on this, and you will see what they think. Use of fire support. I said the reason why this squadron could operate so effectively is because the whole division is geared to react behind it. And that was the key to success. The other is that although we didn't have the DS fire support that other units have, and you artillerymen can expect this if you're in the vicinity of a good air cab unit. Booming into your fire control net at any time of the day or night might well be a cab scout pilot or gun pilot with fire mission. So it behooves you to know their call signs, and if the cab unit commander is on the stick, he will have visited every artillery unit in the area he's operating and given them his call sign so that when he comes on the air with fire mission, there's not a lot of authentication problem involved. Because the cab pilots will shoot more artillery and direct, and I say direct, that's a loose term, more TAC airstrikes than anybody. Simply because they're making the contacts over and over again. So if you've got a troop in your brigade and there's nothing going on, you know you're always going to have at least a scout team or a gun team, maybe both, operating in your area, and they can always handle any kind of fire support that you want adjusted for any reason, in case you don't have an FO or some other individual in position. Now the reason why we got so many airstrikes, many, many times, and this is occurring even now based on some things I talked about at Knox last weekend, many of the fighter strikes coming back from the north are coming back with armament because they can't get into their target. Well, FUCAP, by the way, is fully operational, the new Air Force base up there. The squadron got all of the people they could get from FUCAP to come up and spend a couple of days with them, and they reciprocated. And these people come back and they know the FM frequency of the squadron. If they're coming back loaded, rather than going out and dumping their ordnance in the sea, they come in on the squadron net and say, we're loaded with such and such, have you got a target? Now, you can do this as easily as a brigade. If you've got a battalion, you've got a cab unit that's going to work with you. You can turn that slide off if you want and turn the light on. You saw what I did a while ago. If you've got a brigade and it's too large for you to have habitual operations in it, in other words, let's say you've got three battalions, give the area that you think the battalions can operate in and give the rest of the area to your air cab troop. And this is what happens. This clears that air cab troop to shoot in this area without checking with anybody. This is very important because if you get a fighter strike or a flight of fighters coming back from the north and they call in the squadron and say, we're flight of three, we're loaded with bombs and rockets and napalm mixed, do you have a target? What happens is the squadron will call to the liaison officer that's here at your brigade CP. This is a troop liaison officer. And says, we've got fighters, do you have a target? Well, if you've got a scout team out here, I've never seen one yet, or a gun team commander, that didn't have a suspect target on which he could put that strike. And it doesn't take but a couple minutes, and this is something that is not in the book, and of course the Air Force pilots are ordered not to do it, but I'm told that as recently as last weekend, that these fighters are, in fact, out of FUCAP, dropping at squadron personnel direction in squadron areas, of course, that are not other areas of responsibility. Now, even if you have to use the 01 FAC, in this particular unit, most of the targets we had, we marked with smoke for the FAC. And we said, that grenade is on the target. That's what we want to hit. If you're a brigade commander, you can get a lot of fire support bonus type in your area by using this capability. The same thing is true if you've got artillery and general support. It's outside your brigade area. A lot of that fire coming into, I call it the elsewhere area, can be controlled by the air cab troop. And this is especially true of 8-inch and 175. You can't fire the 175 in close support of your units down in here. But you can sure use it out here in the elsewhere area where you want something that'll crash down through that triple canopy jungle. And that 175 or 8-inch will really tear chunks in that canopy when nothing else will. And as long as you recognize that the 175 is very inaccurate in range, you're all right.
Much long range patrols in that area, they have to tell you where they are at all times if you're doing this kind of pulling in fire.
This, if you've got long range patrols in the air cab area, this troop liaison officer here, your brigade CP, keeps these teams aware at all times of your long range patrols. And in fact, one of the missions that we've done many times is to extract the long range patrols of the brigade when they're pressed. And that's how close we keep track of them. In other words, a combat extraction when they call in and say, we're being trailed. They might be moving from their day position to their night, and they obviously are moving. They get detected, so they're evading. And we've many times had a scout team and a gun team team up and identify where the patrol is and shoot right in behind them as they move down the trail until they get to a place where we can get them out. And most of these extractions would be done by the cab troop with either a gun team or one of their own lift ship because it's kind of a sticky type situation. But a good air cab unit coordinates very closely if they're operating in the area of another unit. They won't shoot unless it's obvious that there are no U.S. troops. They won't shoot into the jungle unless you've given them this area. And that's why I say, give them as much area as you're not going to use, because the reconnaissance by fire starts more fights than any other method we have over there. And that's what I've been talking about, use of the troop. As I said, whether the troop is attached to you in the brigade or whether it's in support of you, the division order could say to the squadron commander, support each brigade with one troop. In that case, you immediately get a liaison officer from the troop, regardless of which mission the squadron's given. And he lives right there at the brigade CP, and he takes all your requirements and passes them on to the troop commander. That troop commander will always be here, if he doesn't have a mission at dawn, shortly after dawn, to make sure that he's providing the kind of support you need.
How about coordination of fires with any Vietnamese, any district headquarters, province chiefs? Did you have any coordination of that sort, or was this all sort of a free fire zone?
Well, no, for example, this is Ben Dinh province. If you say that, what we've done though, if there are no Vietnamese in the area, by prior coordination between your division artillery, whatever your senior artillery headquarters is, you go to the, we rarely had to go to province headquarters, but to district headquarters. And the artillerymen established the rules of engagement. The district chief may say, in the area that you have on your map, we'll call it the brigade AO or division AO, you don't have to clear any targets with me. But follow the basic rules. In other words, you have to get shot out before you can shoot into a village. This is a common rule that we found everywhere. We couldn't shoot into a hamlet. In other words, we couldn't reconnoiter by fire into a hamlet unless we got shot at, and then we were supposed to pinpoint our fire until such time it was obvious that the whole hamlet was fortified, defended. But let's say, for example, in this case, we've got division artillery, and here you would have your battalion FDC. And in each area, you've got a battery. Now you'll notice that I have left this area open. Many times, this area out in here, you could reach with artillery. Obviously, within the battalion area, any missions can be fired in here by this battery, cleared by this battery, except that we had technical fire control, which is a term that was used to, in my battalion, this battalion commander, this FDC, checked all data, initial data. Even though the mission that was to be fired, we'll say, was right there, the battery called this mission to FDC before it was fired, and he checked the coordinates. And it, of course, became especially critical when it got near a boundary, because you might have a unit operating near the boundary. But there was nothing new, there's nothing new about this kind of coordination. Your fire support coordinator is that, you've got an artillery liaison officer, of course, at each of your battalion CPs in the brigade, and he does all of the clearance of fires for that battalion, the infantry battalion, and the battery that's in that battalion's area. Yes?
You just mentioned that you might not be able to put artillery fire into that elsewhere area, that you put long-range patrols. Now, it seems to me that, I heard a briefing a while back, this applied to the Marines, that they never sent patrols out there, that they couldn't give them some sort of support from long-range artillery.
Well, this will vary by unit, and it's certainly a good policy that you should follow, I think, to try and have them within artillery range. Many times, though, we have situations like this where the only thing that we had that could support us out there was 1.75 8-inch. Now, there isn't a better weapon for an 8-inch. Of course, they don't have the volume of fire or rate of fire that you would get from 105 or 155. But you remember, at least I talk, still do, the long-range patrol is successful based on its remaining undetected. And when the time comes that it's detected, we found that in their evading, they were moving so fast nobody could shoot indirect fire for them. You had to have a gunship shooting for them in order to provide effective fire, because if they were being trailed, you couldn't follow it with artillery. Now, but I would agree that where possible, don't put... Now, you noticed a while ago when I drew those, I did that particularly. The battalions put their long-range patrols in their own sector and usually had them covered with artillery fire. The squadron did this type work.
Kim, I think, how about covering 2 points? Number one, the use of especially battalion recon platoons with the rifle platoon. The second one, how about going into the organization, training, and how the battalion supported these long-range patrols, where they got their people, and what it cost you?
Good point. I made a statement back there, and I didn't write it down as one of the things I wanted to cover. There's one rifle platoon in the aircraft troop, but we learned that in a straight recon role, ground recon, one aircraft troop can handle as many as three platoons on the ground simultaneously. Now, it really pushes them. But let me give you a good example of this. Let's say that we are moving into an area for the first time, and you want a very heavy recon in the first couple days. And let's say that you can look over a lot of it by air, but there are other areas which are covered, and you cannot see into them. We always call these targets. Let's say this is one troop. Well, many times, the brigade that had this might do this, and he would say, okay, 2nd of the 8th, 1st of the 8th, provide one platoon to the A troop for recon missions. And what happens then is that that platoon, wherever he is in the LZ, is picked up by the aircraft troop and employed, and usually, see, in the area of that battalion, along with his own rifle platoon. You can double or triple the number of areas that are ground recon in a given period. And many times, we've taken two platoons especially, our own and one other, by troop, per troop, and gone into 8 or 10 areas. Now, you don't leave them on the ground more than 1 to 2 hours, because a lot of the area you may be able to see from the air. But you can make a very intensive recon in a short time by using these additional platoons. And I might add, and we've got two battalion commanders here who can fortify this, there isn't any better way to upgrade the average rifle platoon of an infantry battalion than to have them work with one of these air cav troops. They're out on their own. They get good support. they learn to be very self-sufficient, and I think they upgrade the battalion. You think so, Ken?
Right, I agree.
I had a policy with the squadron that to the maximum extent, I tried to encourage the battalion commanders to give us a different platoon each time, so that over a period of time, we'd upgrade the whole force, that is, towards being a good reconnaissance force. The long-range patrols. When I took our brigade, fortunately, that brigade had battalion commanders like these two gentlemen earlier, it was very easy for me to establish another policy. I said, every fire team, a long-range patrol. That was our goal. Now, that's a rather demanding thing because you'll find that Spec 4s are fire team leaders in most cases. But what I did, in these particular positions, you can see the patrols that are in a battalion area, they're working for him. All I did was designate where I wanted them, what routes I wanted them to watch. But in each fire base, every day, prospective fire team leaders, or fire team leaders who were going on patrol, they sat and they adjusted artillery fire. We had artillery fire service practice going every day in every fire base, teaching these youngsters how to handle the FO duties. In fact, the FO sergeant, many times from all the companies, was back doing just that, teaching fire adjustment.
Captain.
How did you determine when to cover in north, south trails and when you reach west? Based on intelligence data?
Oh, for example, I said that we had 8 contacts within about a 4.5 week period with numbered battalions in an area like this. In each case, we had a pickup in night sightings. And in most cases, they'd say, we're sure we heard something moving on the trail. We didn't spot anything. And when this would pick up, I had another requirement. I would notify the battalion commanders by 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And I'd say that, okay, during daylight hours, tomorrow, I want every hamlet in your zone checked. Well, then they had to sit down and we blanketed the area so that at least a platoon, in most cases, approached every hamlet. And every fight was started, unfortunately, the way it started, as a platoon, spread formation would approach a hamlet. Ordinarily, they'd let them get within 10 meters, and they'd have the boom lowered off, just like this platoon in this combat action I gave. And that's the way they happened at all 8 occasions. And what had happened when we got the prisoners out after the fight, they had come in over a period of 2 nights. It infiltrated in, usually by company, in the manner that I told you. That 3-man recon cell led them through. Now, they didn't get through undetected, but we certainly didn't put any devastating fire on them while they were moving. But I might add, after this happened a number of times, and I thought maybe I was getting too impatient, I sat down one night and remembered that in World War II, I had a recon platoon in Europe. And for about 6 weeks, we did nothing but night patrol into the Siegfried Line. And in front of that Siegfried Line, along the Our River, if any of you were there, you had a complete entanglement of mines, booby traps, and barbed wire. But we went into the Siegfried Line with one patrol from the troop that I was in every night for 6 weeks, officer-led patrols. Now, so I said to myself, well, obviously, well-trained troops can infiltrate anything if they're determined. And these people are well-trained. Their recon personnel are the best trained they have. And it's just amazing to me. We rarely captured recon personnel. Now, we may have killed some, but these 3 that I told you about were a highlight in my time there because we rarely got recon personnel.
Yeah.
To switch the subject, Jim, what was your normal reaction to a downed helicopter?
Normal reaction, before we even knew where it was, we launched the rifle platoon. And usually, while launching, we'd get the coordinates. The scout team or gun team that was in the air closest to it moved to it in order to provide it with covering fire. It was SOP in my squadron S3 section to request immediately an ARA section. That's two ARA rocket ships. Because usually what we needed quickly was all the firepower we could get. We never assumed that we had artillery. And as soon as the scout team or the gun team would get into the area, they would get a fire mission going if there was an artillery unit in within range. Because we never knew what the enemy situation was in the area. Only two or three times did we have to fight to get the ship out. Usually we were in there, and in fact, I was very unhappy if we didn't have the ship out in an hour. And we had an SOP in the division so that just as fast as it would go, also my S3 would alert the Hook Battalion, the Chinooks. And a Chinook would be standing by, and as soon as we had a team in there to sling that ship, either from the unit from which the ship was our own, we had the hook on the way. That's what we call Chinooks. And it would be lifted out of there.
Jim, how about going further into detail and tell them how you got the ship out, the okay. sling team, this type of thing?
Each of the helicopter units that support you will have a maintenance team that's trained to sling these ships. And they have prefabricated slings that they put on them. And then, of course, all you need then is a man there standing on top of the ship to hook it up when the Chinook comes in.
Did you take that in, or would that come in with somebody else?
Well, many times I did it. For example, the artillery battery, the division artillery, aviation battery, they didn't have anybody trained to do this. The brigade aviation platoons didn't have anybody trained to do it. So we always did it because we could expedite it. The more people you get involved in this type of thing who are not well oiled into the machine makes the job a lot more difficult, especially if it's kind of sticky.
Last question, Jack Cole.
You mentioned about the sheet metal work. I know this is getting into the maintenance angle of the repair work, but it's pretty important. Do you do this in the unit, at the time, or squadron level?
We start right where the thing hits the ground, repairing it with the tools that we have available. It's the tools usually that restrict what we can do.
You still have the old method of so many rivets per square inch?
Depends on where the patch is being put. If it's just skin damage, you don't have much stress in that area, you're not too worried. In fact, a lot of times all we did was chalk it with yellow chalk and not worry about it until the ship went in for a periodic maintenance. But if it was in an area where it had to be repaired, like a structural repair, we couldn't do that in the division. That had to go back to our backup maintenance, general support, you know, a stringer or something like that. And that's where we had a real problem if we had stringer damage. Skin damage is not too difficult, it's just time, too. I might add, in this squadron while I had it, in order to keep operating, you recognize in a combat unit, you can't prorate so many ships a day like you can in a lift unit. By the way, I call the lift units truck units. We used to have a lot of fun on these remarks, but I used to say, we're a combat unit. If I'm a tank company, I don't say I'm going to operate only 75% of my available tanks every day. Now, the lift units can do this because they have enough ships. But in our unit, we had to fly everything every day. All we did was fly some more than others in order to stagger the maintenance load. When I had a ship go down, one had been shot down, if I couldn't repair that thing on site, deployed area, within 4 hours, I had that thing slung out, and I showed you the core area. I had it taken all the way back to ONK, and my backup maintenance would work all night long on that ship. And most of the time, that ship would be back with me at dawn. They'd work all night. And in order to get this kind of support, I took the fewest number of people into the field with me. In other words, just people who could look at it and say, I can repair it in 4 hours, or it's a waste of time, get it out. And this is important because, for example, 7 months with a squadron, I was at ONK only 15 days. We were always operating. And, good point. I moved that squadron east to the coast area. In September of 66, that squadron has never gone back to Ancay. It's been deployed and operating ever since. So you gotta have a maintenance system that works, like I said.
Well, I thought that I call Colonel Burdett, now General Burdett, when he was in the 11th Aviation Group, the division's chief truck driver, and he's never forgiven me for it, so I don't advise you to hire any too many of them. You told you before, first cab advocates about the real capability you have when you have your lift ship in your unit. You saw a unit tonight that not only has organic lift, but has organic air fire support. And believe me, that it is a real help, and that commander has that under his thumb. And you'll find that if you ever have a chance to operate with these people, they have, or you can have them operating for you, they can do you a lot of good. Jim, thank you very much. It's been a worthwhile session. Yeah.